Welcome to the Reaction podcast with me, Alistair Benn, from the editorial team at Reaction. This week we're talking about youth culture, millennials, Corbyn and Mogg. And to help me, I've got Lara Prendergast, assistant editor at The Spectator. Thanks for coming on, Lara.
Thanks for having me.
The Conservatives have a massive problem with young people, but not just young people, it's under 40s as well as under 30s. Why do you think this is?
Well, I think there's a quite obvious reason, and I think the Tories are aware of this. If you don't have a group of young people owning property, it's highly unlikely that you're going to be able to convince those people to vote Tory. I think it was The Spectator, actually, in I think the 1920s, that said the best bulwark against socialism is a property-owning class, and that is what is currently missing from most people under the age of 30 don't own their own property. And I think you can see quite obviously that that's what is driving support for Jeremy Corbyn. The Tories, I think, are aware of this, and they are talking obviously about, you know, all these plans for housing. Whether or not it will these plans will happen in time, you know, to stop a Labour government, I don't know. I slightly sense that we're going to get a Labour government, whatever happens, in the kind of cyclical way that these things happen. I think the Tories' other problem, of course, is that they are currently seen as the government enacting Brexit. I think lots of younger people voted to remain, so I think that's another sort of cultural problem for them, is that they've become known as the party of leave.
You mentioned cultural problem. It seems to me that part of the appeal of Corbynism, whatever you want to call it, is that it attaches itself onto sort of several trends in identity. Seeing, for example, identity as something rooted in, for example, like a racial identity or a sexual identity. And Labour seems to have been quite good at attaching itself to those kind of creeds. So it's not just these material things, like not feeling engaged with capitalism. It's also an identity politics. It's very positive in those ways.
It is positive. I think for Labour, the identity politics debate has been helpful so far. But I think you can start to see there are problems arising. For instance, there's this, in the last few days, we've seen this hashtag trending, Labour losing women, which seems to be about how the party is dealing with the issue of transgenderism. James Kirkup did a piece for The Spectator a few days ago too, looking at how Mumsnet are basically turning on Jeremy Corbyn, because many of the women on Mumsnet disagree with the direction that Corbyn seems to be taking the Labour Party in. So I think, you know, I can see why Labour has attached itself to identity, but I think it can be quite a risky strategy, because it's quite easy to alienate people pretty quickly. And I think, you know, Mumsnet is just one part of this, but if the narrative starts to become that kind of Labour is actually quite anti-women, and is pro kind of other groups, that might not necessarily be the greatest thing for the party.
Well, there seems to be a similar dissonance. It's like in the New Labour years, there was definitely that machismo, that, you know, Alistair Campbell, the Brownites, they're quite macho people, but that accusation seems to have morphed into the kind of accusations of brocialism in the Labour Party.
Yeah, and I think you can see why women are getting a bit annoyed about being told that, you know, it's fine, we've got, you know, a women's leader who's a trans person, and, you know, fair enough. But I think you can see how stuff can start to quickly unravel if it looks as if it is just kind of a very male-dominated party.
Yeah.
I think, you know, not everyone likes Theresa May, but she is, you know, the second female prime minister, and she's a Tory, and I think there are aspects of that that, you know, the Tories could capitalise on still. Whether or not they do at the next election, I don't know.
So on the one side you have Labour, who I think are a bit hamstrung because they've done quite well, I think, in addressing some of those identity issues, but now are facing the kind of paradoxical and contradictory consequences. When, you know, it's simply not robust enough to say we're a party that's pro-equality, but then to have these other conflicting commitments. And there's a way of framing that and making that coherent, but I'm not sure they're doing it. And on the other side, you have the Conservative Party, which I think has not engaged with it properly at all. Why are the Tories unable to get into dialogue with those kinds of issues?
I mean, I don't think the Tories are particularly bad on women's rights. And I actually think, you know, if you look at kind of a lot of the environmental stuff, you know, there's this idea of kind of blue conservative, the blue planet conservatives who are now actually, you know, what Michael Gove is doing. I don't know. I mean, I suppose it's never going to be cool to vote Tory. I think that's just something that is always going to be the case. But actually, you need to make it not about just voting because something's cool, really. I think you need to kind of make it, you need to engage people politically. I mean, I've been struck by how many more people, I think, have become engaged politically since the referendum, especially younger people. And a lot of my people I know wouldn't necessarily just vote Labour because that's the kind of cool thing to do. They would probably be much more considerate in their opinion. And you have to remember, I mean, the Tories didn't do too badly at the last... I mean, it wasn't great, but, at the next election, I'm sure they'll try much harder to engage with younger people. I think just trying to copy what Labour is doing is not the answer. It needs to be more authentic, probably driven by younger people anyway, not just driven by kind of CCHQ telling people what to do. And that may well happen. I mean, I think we're still quite far away from the next election, or when we expect the next election to be. And I imagine there probably will be a more kind of youthful spirit behind, there might be a kind of more youthful Tory movement, in the same way that, you know, you've seen in France with Macron. I wouldn't be surprised if something like that happened, partly to reflect people's ideas about the EU and things like housing. But I don't see that kind of getting tough and trying to create some kind of like faux Tory movement is necessarily the answer. I think people can see through that pretty clearly.
Yeah, absolutely. Talking about youth culture and how that might change and might become more conservative in the next few years kind of reminded me, I can't remember why I read this, but it was a kind of thesis about the Cold War that said we didn't win the Cold War because of more nuclear weapons or because we... because in the West we were better at strategy. It's because we had more authentically cool oppositional figures and genuinely radical people, whether it's like the Velvet Underground in Rock or like JFK or like whatever. And on the other side, you had the odd kind of figure like Che Guevara and Fidel Castro, who were very like popular. But most of the time, people saw Eastern Bloc communism and Soviet communism as just boring. All the videos were of endless commissars in double-breasted grey suits in sort of beige, like monochrome beige surroundings. And I wondered whether there's something connected to how the Tories are perceived. There's a kind of boredom about Toryism.
I think that's probably right. I went to Tory party conference for the first time last year, and I wrote an article for The Spectator about it because I was just struck, kind of having never seen it before, by how kind of anodyne... And I wrote about how everyone was wearing this identical blue suit. And it really struck me because I thought, you know, I had sort of pictured this kind of rainbow sort of assortment of conservatives, you know, everyone kind of, you know, some people in sort of tweed suits, older Tories, younger Tories, cool Tories, even more tragic Tories than you kind of see on TV.
Yeah.
But that just wasn't the case. You know, Jacob Rees-Mogg really stood out because he was wearing a double-breasted suit. And I think that's partly their problem, is that there's this sort of idea that they have to be so sort of professional and controlled, and that is boring. You know, you can see that what Jeremy Corbyn is doing seems more attractive to young people, seems more energetic, and I'm not saying they shouldn't wear blue suits, and I think looking professional has many benefits, but I do think you can't really expect people to be, you can't expect younger people to be wanting to get behind a movement if it just feels quite kind of dull. And I think, you know, Theresa May probably doesn't really help. She's not a hugely inspiring leader.
Sort of weird auntie.
Yeah, and I think people are slightly suspicious of anyone who seems a bit, within the Tory party, who seems a bit kind of too energetic, but equally are also gravitating to people who, you know, people like Jacob Rees-Mogg, people like Boris Johnson. I don't know. I mean, I feel like it's probably not great for the Tories to be seen as a boring party. I mean, I don't think they've always had that reputation.
Yeah. Talking about Jacob Rees-Mogg, I mean, I think he's a tired joke, and he's essentially a nostalgia trope, a kind of weird product.
But then so is Jeremy Corbyn.
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to say.
Exactly what he is. Yes. I mean, of all the politicians I met, which is not very many, but Jacob Rees-Mogg is, when I met him at Tory conference, was probably the most charming and engaging politician that I've met, And I can see why people like him. I mean, I don't sort of support his views necessarily, but you can see why someone who's got something a little bit different to them is doing quite well in this age of conformity when everyone else looks the same.
Yeah, I agree. There's something similar about the phenomenon. They both, Mogg, for all his kind of throwback qualities, has actually done very well at using social media. His tweets get a lot of coverage. He's got his own Instagram. He's got his own podcast. He does a lot of the things that a modern politician is expected to do with all these kind of weird nostalgic things. And the same as Corbyn. I mean, whether it's Momentum, whatever, they're brilliant at using social media to get popularity. Bearing that in mind, how do you think social media is changing politics? And is it doing it for the better or the worse?
I do think it has changed politics a lot. I think people... I don't know, I feel like with things like the referendum, for instance, I was struck the morning afterwards by the amount of friends of mine saying, I had no idea this was going to happen. And it was pretty obvious that it was because they didn't really know anyone who was voting Leave. I think working at the Spectator, I was a bit more aware of, you know, more people who were kind of pro Leave, so it wasn't such a surprise, although it was still a surprise. And I think what social media has done is, you know, it's an obvious thing to say, but has created bubbles where people sort of assume that what they think is what everyone thinks, and are then very, very surprised when they find something kind of that contradicts their view. Although I think since sort of Trump and the referendum, people have actually become perhaps a bit more willing to try and engage with other views and to try to seek them out, really. I mean, I think the Spectator has taken on lots of subscribers from people who perhaps weren't necessarily reading the Spectator before the referendum and are now really wanting to kind of hear about what we're saying, and I'm sure it's the same with you guys as well. I think it's going to be interesting seeing kind of, for instance, Italy's election coming up with Beppe Grillo, obviously Trump. I mean, all these things have been driven by social media. There's no denying that. It's obviously the place at the moment where people want to engage with politics, but it can be nasty. I mean, I think it's quite terrifying how vitriolic people are and the sort of stuff that people are willing to say online. I did another piece for the Spectre recently looking at this and looking at the kind of anger online and, you know, just quite how vicious people can be. And I think partly the problem now in politics as well is that the people who have to go into it or want to go into it have to be incredibly thick-skinned and have to sort of basically want to have their entire life poured over and be willing to kind of put everything that they've ever written in the public eye. So yeah, I don't know. I think it has definitely changed it. I'm not sure for the better or the worse. I think it's just changed it, and we don't know. I mean, we don't know what's coming. No one saw Trump coming, and Trump was probably the first kind of social media politician. So I don't know. Whatever comes next might be even more terrifying.
Yeah, and you can build. I think the frightening aspect is you can build coalitions for stuff very, very fast, even though the kind of idea content of what you're doing is quite shallow and very, like, maybe just three things, and you can just build it within
maybe a couple of months. Why I suspect that, you know, if there is a kind of young conservative movement, it's not going to come from CCHQ. It will come from people getting together saying, you know, we disagree with this policy that Labour's doing, or you know, have you seen what's happening here? This isn't right. And coming together around those ideas, and it will be a more organic movement, I think, if it does happen. And it could happen. You know, like you say, it's easy to organise this kind of thing. I suspect that at the moment, because it's not happening, maybe there's just not a demand for it, or maybe it's because the election isn't just around the corner. But yeah, I mean, I can totally see that sort of thing happening.
Yeah.
I don't see why it should, you know, it happened in America. I don't see why Labour should have a stronghold on social media and being good at social media.
You mentioned forgetting on social media, and it reminded me, there's a bit in Milan Kundera's novel, The Book of Large from Forgetting, where he says the struggle of man against power is the struggle of memory against forgetting. But now it seems to be the opposite. It seems to be the ability to forget that is one of the ways you preserve yourself from being sort of hounded to an early grave.
And I've written two things about this back. I did a piece 2 years ago looking at memory and how I thought technology was destroying memory, particularly my own memory. And then I've also did a piece more recently, after all the Toby Young stuff, looking at how You know, basically people were sort of trying to destroy Toby based on stuff that he had said before. And I'm not, you know, I'm not sort of going to defend what Toby said, but I do think it was a good sort of lesson in how these things work nowadays. You know, if you do want to be a politician, you have to be incredibly careful about anything you say or write or do, which wasn't always the case, because people didn't always expect that you're about to kind of find all this information so easily.
Unfortunately, it makes politics paradoxically more managerial.
Of course,
when people don't want that.
You can see why people don the boring blue suit, because it sort of gives you a sense that they're just, you know, your average politician, nothing to see, nothing to hide. So I can see why people are trying to kind of coalesce around this quite sort of boring managerial mode. I think it's bad for politics. I think if you just, everyone is kind of pretending to be the same, or, you know, erasing stuff from their past. But yeah, I think politics now is, you know, it's always been PR, but PR nowadays is about your kind of online profile and your social media profile. And I think the interesting thing is how quickly these things move. So something you said 3 years ago, which was totally fine then and didn't cause huge outrage, can now come back and bite you. And so when you kind of see that happening, you start to think, well, maybe it's just easier not to say anything. And, you know, they always say that about censorship, that, you know, people start to self-censor, and that's kind of the ultimate censorship, really. And I think that's probably starting to happen. I certainly feel nervous sort of posting stuff online. And actually, since the Toby story and since the piece, I've heard of lots of people kind of deleting Twitter or just kind of going through stuff and kind of checking it. But you just don't know what someone's going to use against you in a year, in 10 years, in 20 years.
Yeah. It's horrible. It's like a scrambling of memory, but also a scrambling of your former self in a weird way.
Yeah.
Because this stuff is just there forever, and it can your ghost can confront you. But
exactly.
It's not like Will, just people. We are awakening your former ghost, your former articles.
Yeah.
It's horrible.
I got involved with Varsity when I was at Cambridge, and I think I was one of the sort of last people where all the stuff I wrote wasn't online, and I'm incredibly grateful for that, because nowadays, lots of younger students, if you search for their name, the first thing that comes up is all their student juvenilia, and that's fine, but, you know, you're going to have to kind of stand by all this stuff you wrote as a student, which I think people should be given a kind of grace period and not have to kind of defend some article they wrote aged 18, but it's starting to get to that point where you will have to.
No, I wrote an awful set of blogs about sports for a magazine, which will forever haunt me.
Exactly.
<It's> so pretentious. Thanks very much,
okay.
Laura.
Thanks for having me.
That was The Reaction Podcast with me, Alistair Benn, and the assistant editor of The Spectator, Laura Prendergast. Thanks for listening.